risk is worth taking, the challenge is worth going for. It might not feel like it at the time. It might feel like this was the worst decision you could possibly have made. But with that risk, as you say, comes so much more richness of experience and, you know, appreciation of others. And remembering that on the days when, you know, things aren't going well, or you kind of feel like you're stuck, or you look at, you know, your colleagues or your family or people around you on the train, you think they've got it all figured out. I think it's really important to say that I don't think anyone does.
From Sniper Platoon Commander to His Majesty's Ambassador to Mongolia, via Mogadishu and the United Nations, Fiona Blythe loves a challenging assignment. Serving with the Black Watch shaped Fiona's professional life beyond all imagination. She recognises the benefits of pursuing and seizing life-changing opportunities and, most importantly, learning from them. Join me for this extraordinary tale of remarkable leadership. I'm Lindsay McDuff, the Culture Colonel, and this is my conversation with Fiona. His Majesty's Ambassador, Fiona Blythe, MBE, welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. And I call you that because that's your correct title. I think, should I be calling you Your Excellency as well?
Please don't. Please, Fiona. I am still not used to the title.
So you are the UK's ambassador to Mongolia.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a bit about what that role is, please?
So you're representing, I suppose, officially the king, but you're there to advance British interests. And that can be a whole range of things. So it can be, of course, you know, our sort of bilateral relationship and partnership with the host country. But it's also things like building cultural links. It's about supporting education, about building trade and getting more British investment into Mongolia and more trade between Mongolia and the UK. So it can be quite varied.
How long have you been doing the job for?
Not quite a year yet.
Really?
So I'm still I can still count myself as new.
And you'll do about 3 years, is that right?
Yes, about 3 years.
Yeah. And when you got the job, was it a surprise or not?
As with all civil service jobs, you apply for it in no expectation of getting it. And it was a huge shock. I had come out of a really long, quite tedious meeting with lots of things that are in my inbox that I needed to focus on, and I came out and I found that email telling me that I'd been appointed. And I think it's quite literally life-changing, isn't it, when you get opportunities like that.
And were you in London when you were fighting your inbox?
Of course. I was fighting heroically in the Cabinet Office at the time.
We're not in Mongolia, I should say. We're recording in the UK, and you are back to receive your MBE for great work that you did whilst in London.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And it was such an incredible honour to be nominated for it and then to receive it. And it's funny because I have mixed feelings about it, because obviously I'm thrilled and it feels like an enormous privilege. But it's funny, isn't it, because we've all worked with and alongside people doing extraordinary jobs every single day, and not everybody gets recognised. So I'm so grateful to get it, but when I look back over that time, I don't think that I did something that was particularly extraordinary. I think the team did something that was particularly extraordinary. And so when I was having that experience, I think I was thinking a lot about them and the experience that we went through together.
The importance of team, I think, might be a theme of today, because we first met quite some years ago. And the reason we met was because I was commanding the Black Watch Battalion and I was short of platoon commanders. You were at Sandhurst, I think.
Sandhurst, yes.
Can you talk a bit about how that came about from your perspective?
As you know, and many others know, as you get towards the end of your time at Sandhurst, you do start to think about what life in the field army is going to be like. But I don't think we had, certainly I didn't have much of an understanding of what that looked like in reality. I knew that I was commissioning into the Intelligence Corps, which comes with this incredible experience of doing an attachment to the infantry before you start your phase two training. I think it's actually a really interesting model, actually, that you should get to know your customer and get to know what your customer's requirements are before you start to be the provider of those requirements. So it is an incredible, I think, system. You all go to Sandhurst to become infantry platoon commanders. And so I was actually quite excited about the idea of trying out what being in the infantry was like. I also have links to Scotland. And so when I found out it was going to be the Black Watch, I was thrilled, but pretty scared. And my experience of first meeting you was alongside still one of my best friends, Vicky, and we came to see you at Sandhurst, not a place known for its warmth and support, probably these days very different. And you welcomed us immediately into this family and provided so much reassurance and warmth, I think. And it made the whole thing a lot easier.
Well, that's very kind. My recollection of the experience is that I had asked for two platoon commanders and I got a phone call, I think it was, and they said, I've got good news and bad news. The good news is that you've got two platoon commanders. The bad news is that they're girls. And actually, the challenge for you was probably greater than you even expected it to be, because one of the gaps I had was to command the sniper platoon. And for those not intimately involved in understanding what the infantry is like, in the hierarchy of weirdness and challenge, the sniper platoon is probably in a league of its own.
It's up there. It's definitely up there.
When you arrived, accepting that you said I was reassuring and welcoming, how was it when you got there?
So I think Sandhurst gives you a bit of armour, because it sort of tells you that this is going to be what the sort of shape of your unit is going to look like, and this is broadly your role within it. So I didn't feel totally unprepared, but what I did feel unprepared for, I think, was I hadn't, up until that point, realised the kind of personal bonds that make a fighting unit a reality. The battalion was coming off the back of a really intense period of operations, and that left its mark in a number of ways on absolutely everyone, I'm sure. And so I think I arrived as an outsider in many respects, you know, gender being one of them, inexperience being another. But what I quickly realised was that actually what bound these people together, what bound you all together, was the experiences that you'd shared that I could just have no comprehension of. The period that I spent with you and with the battalion has shaped my professional life beyond all imagination, not just the kind of military aspects to it, but, you know, we can go on to talk about sort of teamwork and that sort of thing. But one of the very early things that I did, I think, on the first day was I just felt like I have to try and understand people as individuals and what their hopes and dreams are and how their feelings and how they interact with one another. Because I think how do you even sort of start to penetrate that? And the way that I did then, and I've actually tried to replicate a few times since, is to try and understand the individuals that make up that unit. So it was daunting, but not unfriendly. The fact that they accepted me as, you know, not a sniper, not from Fife, not having been through the fires that they'd been through, says extraordinary things about them as a unit as well.
Just for context, this was in 2007.
Yes.
You referenced that the battalion had been had a busy operational experience in 2003 and 2004, and we'd moved at the end of 2005 to Belfast. Mm-hmm. We still had people who were deploying on operations into Iraq from there. But the environment that we found ourselves in was still an operation environment. Yeah. And the policy said at the time that women could not command infantry soldiers on operations. What that meant is that when we were in barracks, because we were there for 2 years or more, that you could command the sniper platoon.
But then as soon as you stepped outside of the barracks on operational activity, you should have reverted to being a jock in the platoon. I had a discussion with my amazing second-in-command about how we would manage this, because we thought it would be incredible, i.e. it would not work for your credibility if we implemented that policy. And so we failed to tell you what the policy was and judged that two things. Firstly, if there was an incident, we had no doubt that you would respond brilliantly anyway. And so we would thought we would then be able to use it as a precedent for maybe considering changing the policy. But actually, the reality was the operational environment was such that it was unlikely that there was going to be any kind of incident. So we did our risk assessment, for those that are listening, carefully.
But, for the paperwork.
But that that approach was formative for me too, because years later, I was talking to some cadets at Sandhurst about women in ground close combat and what they thought their thoughts were. They had their views and they asked me my thoughts. And I talked about you and how you were one of the most capable platoon commanders I had, and that you were commanding the sniper platoon, which was a really complex command in itself. A hand went up and I asked the cadet what they wanted to say. And he said, I was in her platoon and she was the best leader I ever had. And for me, it was wonderful to hear that, but also important that you heard it too. You talked earlier about how it informed all of your career since then.
Yeah.
Can we look a little bit about what that looks like?
Yes, and I mean, that's an incredible thing for you to say and for the cadet to say, because whoever knows the impact that we leave on people in our team and people that we've worked with. So it is incredible to me that he had a positive memory of that. I should also say as well, thank you for putting your trust in me as a very, very newly commissioned officer. I think that is something that is extraordinary about our armed forces, that we do that early on. And some of my close friends from Sandhurst went out and immediately went out to Iraq or in some cases Afghanistan and were put in really, really, really challenging situations. And it is fantastic to me that you were prepared to put your trust in me and to navigate the policies to allow me to have that experience, because it has shaped everything else. I felt that I desperately wanted to put all the things that I'd been learning at Sandhurst into action, but I really didn't know what that was going to look like in practice. I feel like that every day, that I know in theory what I'm supposed to be doing, but what does that look like in practice? And what does that look like when all of your training sort of hits a real person? And so today I can think, well, you know, I did that with, you know, when I was in Belfast with a pretty tough crowd. I ended up learning so much from them. So if I could do it then at a much younger age, with much more naivety, but also much less experience, then it's probably going to be all right. And it helps you take that first step, I think.
You haven't shied away from tough challenges in your career since then, too, because you worked for the UN in Mogadishu. Did you have a plan to do that? How has your career evolved?
Does anyone have a plan?
Well, some people say they have a plan.
Oh,
and some people say they want to be the head of the army.
Yeah.
I was reminded that my colour sergeant instructor at Sandhurst said that you should put a coin in your bucket, a virtual bucket, when you're having a good time. And when you're having a bad time, you take the coin out of the bucket. And when the bucket's empty, it's time to do something else. That's great advice. And it's great life advice as well. But if you want to be the top surgeon in the country, you probably have to, your bucket may be empty, but you still have to pursue it. Mm. There's a passion part of that that I think is really important, that one should live your life doing things that you're passionate about. Is that what has influenced and shaped your career? What have been the influences that have shaped your career?
So I think that I can make a coherent argument in reverse that what I have done is a career, but it hasn't felt like that at the time, and I felt really, really envious of people that did know what they wanted to do, my sister's a vet. As you say, if you want to be a vet, you have to like get on with that pretty quickly. And there is a pretty established track that you have to go down. And she would say it's harder because if you don't achieve what you want to, then there's nothing else. Mm. I have always challenged that and said, but at least you know where you're heading and at least you have a goal. I have not had that, but what I have had is a series of incredible opportunities that I've been able to take. Nothing is cost-free, of course, so you have to make big choices along the way, and I'm conscious that I could not have taken these opportunities if I had other responsibilities, for example, if I had, you know, I don't have children, and that brings with it other choices. So I, in reverse, can say, oh, well, you know, I was sort of heading broadly in this direction. But the absolute reality is that I actually have quite a narrow worldview. I didn't know that many of these opportunities existed when I was growing up. And so each opportunity has come as a surprise along the way. When I was doing the job before, I realised that you could do this incredible other thing, and that exists, and it's possible. And so I followed it that way. I would also say, and this, I suppose, comes back a bit to sort of things like receiving honours and being recognised for work. It seems odd that we recognise individuals, because it's never because of an individual that the story unfolds. It's because of someone is kind to you, someone welcomes you into an unknown world, as you did. You know, someone gives you an opportunity, someone takes a chance on you, someone believes in you, someone says, I'm going to find a way around that policy. And then that creates those opportunities. And so it does feel that I'm here doing this job as a result of all of the people like you who took a chance and you gave me those opportunities. And it feels like I'm kind of like flanked by shadowy figures every day, because that's how the opportunities came up.
Just rewinding, why did you join the army?
It was a complete shock to absolutely everybody I know, including, I suppose, a little bit myself. Mm-hmm. I felt that I had some potential inside me, which I honestly didn't know what it was. I just felt there was something. And I'd kind of was working in London, having a lovely life and in my 20s. But I felt a bit like there was something more, and I couldn't put my finger on what more was. Through probably like sort of randomness and the internet rabbit hole, I signed up for an appointment at an army recruiting office, and I was so mortified that I'd actually done it the next day that I went to apologise and say, I'm really sorry for wasting your time. And they said, not so fast. Why don't you just kind of see what this is about? And so I did. And no one in my family is from the military. I had one or two friends who were in the army, but I didn't really have a good idea about what it was like. So again, what an incredible opportunity.
And this journey of discovery that you went on to join the army, do you think you're on a journey of discovery still? And do you know what it is that you're looking for?
Oh gosh, that's a really good question. Yes, I think so. I think for all of us, there is a bit of searching. Do I know what it is for? I think it is for, I'm trying to think what the correct grammatical formulation of worthwhileness is.
That sounds good to me.
That's the word that comes into my head, doing something that's worthwhile. Now, if I was doing something that was really worthwhile, I would probably be going and working in a refugee camp in Gaza or something like that. But I don't think I have any particularly useful skills to do something as truly worthwhile as that. So I can take some of the things that I've just learnt along the way and try to use them in a worthwhile way. Sometimes I feel like that's the case, and sometimes less so.
And we talked about teamwork earlier, and you've talked about the shadows surrounding you in a very self-deprecating way. But the importance of teamwork is clear for you, and probably formed whilst you were at Sandhurst and beyond. Have you taken that sense of teamwork with you and in your subsequent career, the jobs that you've done? And how does it differ between your time when you served in the army and subsequently?
I do carry it with me. In fact, the first thing I said when I arrived with my new team in Mongolia, my very first day in the embassy, I said, teamwork is really important to me. They probably cringed when I did this, but I used the example of a Mongolian queen who had five sons. They fought between themselves and she took an arrow and broke it and said, look how easy it is to break a single arrow. She took five, she gave it to her sons and said, break it. It's impossible to break. And it demonstrates very clearly through quite a cringing Mongolian lens, you know, the strength of teamwork. But you're absolutely right, it looks different in different contexts. I spent 3 years working for the UN in Somalia, which you mentioned, and before that I'd worked for the British government. And in government, there's a way of talking and there's a way of communicating, there's a way of writing, there's a way of briefing that implies or confers credibility. That actually is like completely nothing to do with the substance. The way you stand, the way you communicate, there's a way that business is done. And one of the many things, fantastic things about working for the United Nations is that you are exposed to different ways of doing things. And I was in a situation where we had to deliver this huge event. It was 50 ministers coming to Mogadishu to have this big conference with the government. And of course, you can imagine all the oopla like that goes with that, you know, the security, but also like the protocol and the, you know, and then way down the line, there's the substance, right? The event was taking place at the international airport and it meant that a lot of ministers were flying in for the day. And the guy that was in charge of the flights and of getting of all the logistics, I remember he was an Ethiopian colleague. And when I first met him in the first meeting, I remember thinking, I'm quite worried. He doesn't really sound on top of the detail. So I kept, you know, sort of not very subtly kind of micromanaging like the logistics and asking lots of annoying questions. And he sort of, you know, he kind of bore with me. I think he'd obviously experienced this before. And in the course of our working together, I realised that he is one of the most effective, experienced, brilliant people that I've ever worked with. And when it got to the actual event itself, that was the one piece I was absolutely not worried about. And so what I learned from that was he communicates his expertise differently, but it's equally, if not more valid, than all of these things that I've been told for years are the way. So I think that kind of learning those lessons along the way and learning that different people bring different things to the team, and in the end it makes it stronger.
Your life is full of highs, I guess, and exciting things. But when you're looking at what you're trying to achieve in Mongolia to deepen the UK-Mongolian relationship, how much scope and flexibility do you have to exploit into areas of that you think are particularly relevant and important?
There are some lovely moments, or actually for me, like it's still a bit cringy moments where you're the ambassador and where, you know, there's a nice flag on your car or people call you Excellency. Then you go very quickly from that to the most practical, and when it comes to, you know, sort of big events, perhaps the most invisible aspects of the job, because we are a small team, we all have to do that. I actually think that's one of the best bits about it. I think it would be a loss to have to give up some of the more kind of practical sides of things. But I also think it's good because I think also recognising where you're terrible at things, and this is where I think the team comes in again, recognising where you actually really need somebody who is like completely the 180 to you, has a completely different skill set, has a completely different experience. And as you said, valuing that difference is such a big part of building the right team. Because how ineffective to have, you know, three people like me, like you need one person like me and two people who are completely different.
And you talked about the self-awareness of knowing what you're terrible at.
Yeah.
Some people don't have that self-awareness. Therefore, it's much more important for them to have people around them that are able to tell them, or indeed that they create the conditions that allow people to say, actually, you know, there's maybe an area of development for you is this. How do you create the conditions that allow people to do that?
Gosh, it's hard, isn't it? One of the many things that Santos gave me is an absolutely crystal clear idea of my failings. So I think every appraisal I've had since, you know, much as we all work on our development points and kind of try and change, you know, and try and improve, similar themes come up again and again. And I think that creating those conditions for honest conversations about development and about what the team needs as well, because of course, like, it's so important that you feel a personal sense of satisfaction in what we're all doing. But I think, you know, I am quite committed to this kind of collective endeavour concept. And so part of it for me is about having those conversations about what the team needs and what we together need to work on. I have had to, as we all do, you know, in leadership roles, have had to have some not easy conversations. You know, it's never easy when you have to, like, sort of say to people, well, you know, actually, I don't think you should be doing it like this. I think it needs to be a bit more like this. And I try and do it from a point of view of safety, whereby having development conversations with people is more about giving them the opportunity to get things back on track, or giving people the opportunity to take things in a slightly different direction, and making them feel supported in that, and that it is not just for them to fix. You know, I sort of talked a bit about when you achieve things, it's not just as a result of you individually. But when you don't achieve things, it's also not just a result of you individually. If someone's not performing, or if someone is not on track, then it's not just that person's responsibility. Of course, it is for them to, you know, examine, think about, try and, you know, sort of reflect on. But it's also about the team and the ecosystem that you're creating for them as well.
Now, you haven't even done a year as the ambassador, and time, I think, goes fast and slow. Presumably, you wanted your time in London to go fast, but you'd like your time in Mongolia to go slowly. Do you have a plan about what might come next, or is that too far over the horizon?
I'm like everybody. I have days where I think, I'd just like to go and sit on a farm in Scotland and just, you know, think great thoughts or something and just sort of run away from the world. But no, I don't really have a plan. I love doing the sort of work that I'm having the chance to do in Mongolia. I love being out in the world, having these incredible experiences, and doing what I do hope is something that's worthwhile. So I hope that whatever I can do next will build on that in some way, maybe take some aspect of what I'm doing now and doing it maybe at a more senior level, maybe with a bigger team, maybe in a different place. But nothing is for granted. You know, it's a really difficult time in government at the moment. There's sort of a lot of conversations about budgets and headcounts and that kind of thing. So it's competitive. So whatever comes next, I will throw my hat into the ring, I hope, for some challenges, because as you said, that's something I do enjoy. Maybe not always at the time, but I'm always, always grateful that I've done them. So I will apply for other things. I'd love to go back to Africa. I loved being in Somalia, and if the opportunity came to go back in that direction, that would be amazing. But I'm also conscious of the excellence of my colleagues, and that I will be up against pretty tough competition, I think.
But you've got time now.
I've got time now, yes. Yeah. I see, you know, in my line of work, lots of people who look like they are, in inverted commas, successful, and look like they had a very linear lily pad jumps from marvellous successful experience to the next. And I feel very strongly that that is not reality, and that we don't often talk about how messy progress is and how messy each of our journeys can be. But I feel very strongly that life isn't like that, and that it is a lot messier, and that there are times when you don't get the job that you want. There are times when you blow the big briefing. There are times when you don't handle something as well as you had hoped or planned for. And as I sort of talk a bit more about some of the jobs and, you know, sort of path that I've taken, one thing I always do try and say is that I know it can look like, oh, you know, I did all these interesting international jobs. It wasn't always going to be that way, and it wasn't always, I think for all of us, it's not linear. And so having and remembering that on the days when, you know, things aren't going well, or you kind of feel like you're stuck, or you look at, you know, your colleagues or your family or people around you on the train, you think they've got it all figured out. I think it's really important to say that I don't think anyone does.
There's a saying that you don't know the storms that other people are enduring.
Yeah.
But part of that is a preparedness to be honest. And combined with that is, on the receiving end, an ability to think with either forgiveness or with kindness. And that risk that you take is, of course, uncertain, but there's a degree of faith that needs to be taken, because the benefits of stepping into that space is rewarding both for the person making themselves honest and vulnerable, but also the opportunity for the relationship. You talked earlier about understanding and knowing your people so you can get the best from them. You can only get that by stepping into that space of uncertainty, to then learn together about how to get through things.
Yeah, and I think that's true, and I think that that's maybe why I do try and seek out those challenges, because growth is painful, learning is painful, and it's only when you look back and you think, it's only then that you can really be grateful for what you learned. And along the way, I do try and remember that, the risk is worth taking, the challenge is worth going for. It might not feel like it at the time. It might feel like this was the worst decision you could possibly have made. But with that risk, as you say, comes so much more richness of experience and, you know, appreciation of others. And as I sort of trip up many times on this path, I think it also reduces your judgment of others. You know, it increases your compassion of other people's choices. And I think that can only be a positive thing for everyone.
Fiona, what a fantastic conversation we've been having. It's so good to see you, and thank you so much for coming and joining us on the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Fiona is quietly driven and determined. There's a steeliness in her motivation to create high-performing teams. Her sense of fun shines through in the warmth and positivity in her voice. It's clear she knows the value of understanding people and the importance of teamwork. For me, her optimism and self-reflection stood out, but I'd love to know what you've learned from our conversation. Send me an email at theculturekernel@bfbs.com. Take care until next time.